Hello, everyone, and welcome to the All Creatures Podcast. I'm Angie, and today I'll be interviewing Dr. Rachel Santemeyer from the Lincoln Park Zoo, who is the director of the Davie Center for Epidemiology and Endocrinology. And she's here with us today to talk about black-footed ferrets. She's a specialist in their conservation and reproductive biology, and it's a real honor to have her here because black-footed ferrets, as we've discussed in one of the previous podcasts, if you haven't listened to it, please check it out. Black-footed ferrets are one of the most endangered mammals in North America, and Rachel works hand-in-hand with them on a very frequent basis. So welcome, Dr. Rachel. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me and having me talk about one of my favorite animals in the world.
Oh, we're really glad that you're here. And for my listeners out there, this to me is like a very, very special interview because Dr. Santemeyer, or Rachel as I call her, of course, is one of my dear friends and my number one mentor when it comes to wildlife conservation and physiology. So I'm going to embarrass her a little bit because I know she doesn't like to be doted on. But I'm going to dote on her today because if it wasn't for her and her taking me under her wing and hopefully seeing that spark in my eye about biology and physiology when I was a young keeper at Lincoln Park Zoo, if it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't be sitting here today and I most likely would not be at the University of Florida working towards my graduate degree. She was just a real inspiration, and I want to applaud her and just tell her how much I love her.
Good thing this is a podcast. You can't see me all teary.
I know. But you were so great. I was young, and you let me go into your lab and play with your fancy pipettes and do some assays and things I didn't even know what they were at the time. And it was just a really cool experience because I was like, I want to be just like her. So hopefully someday I will make you proud and do some really cool stuff like you. I don't know if I'll specialize in black-footed ferrets, but maybe rhinos or zebras or something else. So something with hoofs and horns, of course. But thank you for agreeing to be here with me today. And I'm just excited for the listeners to learn about your expertise with black-footed ferrets.
Great. I'm excited.
Why don't you give the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. Of course, I was one of those people that loved animals, and I thought, you know, if this is what you're passionate about, then you became a veterinarian. And, you know, as in high school and all through college, I worked at veterinary offices. I was at Clemson University in South Carolina studying pre-veterinary science. And I applied to vet school, had an interview at Tuskegee in Alabama, and literally there was one person in front of me that changed my whole life.
Oh.
I didn't get in because of this person, you know, had a better application. And so this scientist came down from the National Zoo and talked at Clemson about how he was an animal scientist, and he was using all the methods that we've learned, like artificial insemination and semen evaluation, and applying it to endangered species like the clouded leopard and the cheetah. And this was Dr. Dave Wilt at the Smithsonian's National Zoo. And I thought, wow, that is the coolest thing ever. That's what I want to do.
Oh my goodness. We need to, that person that was one ahead of you, we need to shake
really?
Their hand and be so happy that they were the one ahead of you because it worked out for so many animals and myself. It definitely benefited us. And then you were able to follow your inspiration more into the wildlife, reproductive physiology
yes,
pursuit.
Yep. Uh-huh. And so I sort of stuck with that, and I actually stayed at Clemson and got my master's in animal physiology, specializing in reproduction, but worked at the zoo, the Riverbank Zoo in Columbia, South Carolina, and studied black howler monkey reproduction. And, you know, my parents were so proud because I think my dad said that my thesis was X-rated because I mentioned, you know, reproductive technologies like semen collection and using feces for testosterone analysis in the black howler monkey. So he thanked me for the thesis, but said he couldn't read it. So.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. Yes, if you're specializing in reproductive physiology, I teach a lot of courses and TA them, and you have to get very comfortable using words that make you and your students a little yes. uncomfortable. And sometimes you just got to let them get the giggles out. And so how did you then get involved with the zoo in the
So state? Because I did my master's at the zoo, Riverbank Zoo, I then actually got asked to become a technician in the endocrinology lab at the Smithsonian's National Zoo. And there I learned so much because we worked with so many different wow. species under Dr. Janine Brown. And I just, I mean, I learned about all the issues that you had to deal with when you're trying to get samples, especially if you're in, you know, working in the field in Africa, for example. And then I decided mm-hmm. that I did that for a couple of years and I decided that I wanted to do my own projects. And so I stayed there and worked, did my, mm-hmm. my research with the Smithsonian, but went to George Mason University for their environmental science and public policy program.
Cool. Wow. Yeah. You definitely were working with some of the top programs in the country, which I would imagine is very inspiring.
Yeah. It was just, it's just really awesome to be able to work directly with the endangered species. And, you know, sometimes we have to use a model species, like for the black-footed ferrets, where you use the domestic ferret as a model. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, with my PhD, I got to work directly on the black-footed ferret. And even as a side project, got to go out to the wild and trap up wild black-footed ferrets. And one of the most rewarding things for me actually was when we were trapping up ferrets, wild ferrets in Mexico. We trapped up a captive-born male that'd been out in the field for about 2 years, surviving and thriving, mm-hmm. and he was actually born at the National Zoo and preconditioned, so they go through this boot camp before they're certified from the Fish and Wildlife Service to be released in the wild, like, yes, you can be successful. They get the little stamp of approval. And so this male was born at the zoo. He was prepared for the wild at the zoo, and then he was living successfully in the wild. And that sort of immediately was a career checkoff wow. for me. Like, all right, well, that one's done. What can I do next? So,
all right, like full circle. That's yes. just incredible. And so now what was your dissertation work studying black-footed ferrets on?
It was on really sort of a technique dissertation looking at mm-hmm. better ways to cryopreserve semen so that we could use that for a strategy to maintain the population for long term. You know, if something happened and we lost all our live ferrets, we may be able to use these gametes to rescue them.
Yes, I was reading a story about one of the males. I don't know if he was part of the original population, but his name was Scarface, and that they had cryopreserved some of his semen, and he was able to sire offspring 20 years later after he had passed away.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? He was one of the last ferrets removed from the wild in that effort in the beginning to rescue the species from extinction. So he was one of those tricky males that they knew he's out there and they could see his footprints and his snow. When they did snow tracking and such. But he was crafty, you know, and he actually was one of the most successful males when he was alive. He sired a lot of offspring wow. in the beginning and really helped the program get started.
That is so cool. Yeah, I have goosebumps when I think about that story. And it's just pretty amazing, the whole black-footed ferret story. And for those of the listeners that haven't tuned into our previous podcast, could you give us a brief synopsis on their story from being extinct to then, obviously, their rebound efforts?
Yeah, so in the 70s, you know, they really thought this species was extinct, and they found one population in Millette County, South Dakota. And they really mm-hmm. didn't know anything about the biology of ferrets in general. And so they were out in the field monitoring them, just trying to figure out what was going on. And they even brought a handful of those individuals to start up a captive breeding program, which ended up not being successful because we just really didn't know about ferret biology. And then when mm-hmm. that population fizzled out, they actually thought the whole species was extinct. And then in about 1985, this dog named Shep in Meteetse, Wyoming, was fighting with something in the middle of the night. And the owners went out the next day, and they found this dead creature on their porch. And they were like, they didn't know what it was. And so Mrs. Hogg, mm-hmm. the Hogg family that found this creature, took it to a taxidermist to have it stuffed, and the taxidermist actually identified it as being a black-footed ferret. And that really is how they found the last population of the species. And there's a lot of political debate about what to do now, since, you know, just monitoring in the wild had failed. Mm-hmm. A captive breeding program was not successful. And who was to oversee the program if they were to start up another captive breeding program? The Fish and Wildlife Service or, you know, Wyoming Game and Fish? And so after all this two-year debate, the ferret population started to die off. They saw prairie dogs dying from salvatic plague, which is introduced disease, mm-hmm. one of our nemesis when it comes to recovering the ferrets. And so the last-ditch mm-hmm. effort was to pull all the remaining ferrets from the wild. And originally it was 24, but 6 died almost immediately, and a lot of them, they think, were dying from either plague or canine distemper virus. And then we left us with 18 mm-hmm. to start up a whole captive breeding program. And so all the ferrets we have today, and 30 wow. years later, you know, come from these 18, and only actually 7 of those 18 produced offspring that survived. So all the ferrets we have come from 7 founders.
And how many ferrets are there now currently?
Well, in those 30 years, we produce over 9,000 black-footed ferrets from those 7 founders.
Wow.
Ferrets are pretty short-lived, particularly in the wild. They may live 2 to 4 years. You know, in a zoo setting, they live a little bit longer. You know, they could live up to be 7 years old. So today, probably on the planet, we have less than 700 black-footed ferrets. And that includes in the breeding program, in the wild, and then also sort of the zoos that exhibit them.
Okay, so there are some on display at zoos?
Yeah, just to get people connected with one of the rarest mammals that we have here in North America.
And speaking of zoos, you work at the Lincoln Park Zoo, which is where you and I met. And I fell head over heels for Dr. Santemeyer as an endocrinologist and reproductive biologist. So the Lincoln Park Zoo supports your efforts to help work with the black-footed ferrets, both in the wild and in a captive setting. Can you explain some of the specifics of what you do for the zoo and for black-footed ferrets?
Sure, yeah. At the zoo, they call me Dr. Poop because most of the research I do involves poop and feces.
Yes.
And we take a non-invasive approach to understanding the physiology of the animals we have at our zoo. And that's to make sure that their welfare is good. And also that, you know, sometimes it's basic questions like, is the animal pregnant? And we can actually extract hormones from feces to look at these measures. And my program focuses mostly on reproduction and stress. And we, you know, collect a lot of feces from our animals here at the zoo. You know, the animal care staff is going to already pick up the samples so they can literally just put it in a Ziploc bag, as you know, and throw it in a freezer.
Interestingly enough, I still have Ziploc bags that were not used, but they were labeled in either days that perhaps the animal had stepped in the defecation or we weren't able to use it. And so they're kind of fun. They're like some of my mementos, kind of fond memories of, yes, collecting feces for you when we first met.
So we collect these samples, and we can really see what goes on inside the animal. And as I tell most of the animal behavioralists, if anybody's had a cat or a dog, you know they can hide certain things from you. And they're very good at hiding something that may make them excluded from a group. Mm-hmm. And so my physiological measures actually show how they're responding to their environment, whether they think it was a stressful day the day before or they're ready to breed. We can really look at those and compare them to the behavior that we're seeing.
So you can learn a lot about how an animal is feeling and some of their physiological parameters by looking at their poop.
Yeah.
Which and now is so we've cool.
Even now we've even branched to other samples like toenails. We use horse hooves, for example, hair. You know, even from our African penguins, we're collecting toenails to look at stress levels. When they trim the pony's hooves, we're getting those samples. We can do feathers. So those samples give a longer term perspective of what's going on with the stress levels. So
very cool. And so the field of endocrinology and looking at endocrine hormones and in your area, particularly stress or reproductive hormones, it's growing now. It's not just about blood and feces and urine. So like you're saying, there's hair involved or toenails. And then, and recently, didn't you do some work with frogs? Is it frogs?
Yeah, several amphibian species. Yeah, we call it affectionately our frog swabs. And because one of my arch nemesis is the elusive pooper. And if you've had a cat, you know that they bury their feces. So if you wanted to study wild cats, it makes it very difficult. And amphibians are sort of the same where, you know, I was naive and I thought, you know, just when you pick up a toad, it urinates on you to deter predation, right? I thought, oh, yeah, all amphibians did this. So when we were going to study the prevalence of the chytrid fungus in Chicago, I thought, oh, sure, when you pick up the frog or the toad or the salamander, you're going to, you know, it's going to urinate on you, and we can use that to measure their stress levels to see how they're responding to their environment and how that may affect their susceptibility to the chytrid fungus. Well, I guess if you live in the water, you know, you're not going to use urine to deter being eaten by a predator. So they were, even the toads were very stubborn and
fair
would
enough.
Not pee for us. Well, I said, well, you know, the skin is actually an endocrine gland. So let's swab the skin. And we have a set method to do that. And then we'll just see if we can find any stress hormones. And lo and behold, we can. All you have to do is swab the frog.
So cool.
The salamander. Wow. We did fully aquatic, like axolotl species. We did semi-aquatic, and we did terrestrial and arboreal species. And
wow.
It works. Even the dry toad gives a great stress response just by swabbing the skin.
And you don't get peed on. It's like a win-win. Because honestly, poop is no problem. Poop is contained, but yeah, urine. I've had to work on a lot of research projects collecting urine from horses, and it is a mess, and it sticks on your clothes, and your shoes are just pretty much worthless after one of those projects.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But skin swabbing is very cool. So that's awesome.
Yeah, we're pretty excited by that. That just came out in Conservation Physiology. So.
And now, Rachel, since you're the expert in black-footed ferrets, can you tell me some fun facts that listeners might not know since you've worked hand-in-hand with them for so many years?
Well, yeah, from my personal experience, they're pretty smelly. They're mustelids, right? So they have these anal glands, and they use it probably for attracting each other, but also, you know, deterring predators. And they may be small. Like, the females are about 600 grams, and the males are about, you know, probably about double that size, you know, around 1 kilogram. And they are strong.
Oh.
I tell you, they are. So when we capture them, they come into our mobile hospital in a tube, like the black landscaping tube that you use. And sometimes if they're stubborn, we have to put on a welding glove and sort of do the plunger to get them into the anesthesia chamber, the induction chamber. And, you know, these little females that are out in the wild, they are tough. They are so strong. You know me. I lift weights. I tell you what, I was
struggling. She's strong, folks.
They are, wow.
Oh,
they are very
gosh.
Strong. And so we would be in trouble if these were 200-pound, you know, animals. But they're not. But they eat prey, the prairie dog, right? They evolved to eat this ground rodent species we found out west. And that's pretty much all they will eat. But, you know, except for some moms, as you experience, moms will save the good meat, like the prairie dog, for their kits, their offspring. And she will eat sort of rodents to snack along the way, right?
Moms.
By trying to provide for her kits. I know I do that.
I definitely find myself eating a lot of side leftover cold chicken nuggets when my kids are eating like the wonderful fresh, you know, whatever
like,
it is.
Oh, you want my steak?
Yes.
Oh, please take it. You know, like whatever. Yeah. You just make sure you're eating good food. I will eat whatever.
Make sure you're Yes, us moms get a lot of leftovers. That's so cool that they do that too. Wow,
they do that too, and they found that through stable isotopes, you know, through the hair, you know, what they're actually eating, and not just eating prairie dogs, but so they have to be strong because their prey species is twice the size of them, just about.
I know. I've seen some videos when I was researching before our previous black-footed ferret episode, and I mean, prairie dogs are huge.
Yeah.
the fact that they, you know, this is what they hunt and that they can take them down is very impressive.
Yeah, and they're just very stealthy, and, you know, they sneak down into the burrows at night and really get them when they're not paying attention, and take them down. And it's just amazing that they can do that. And, you know, for me, one of my struggles working with them is they're nocturnal, you know, active at night. Mm-hmm. And I'm a morning person. So when we had to go out to the field and we're looking for black-footed ferrets, it's up all night. You know, we're up all night, sometimes even into the next day. But
lots of coffee.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, actually, I pull out the Mountain Dew at the time.
Oh, wow.
The heavy hitter.
That's a flashback to my freshman college years when I would, you know, save studying for like the night before, and Mountain Dew was
Mountain
the only
Dew.
Time I ever Tell drink you. It.
That's right.
Oh, that's so funny. Wow. Yeah, I guess I always talk about in the podcast how difficult it can be to study nocturnal species and or count the populations because they're nocturnal. And just putting that visual of you being a morning person and then having to be up all night to track these guys it really sinks home all the hard work and dedication that you and I'm sure the staff you work with, what you do and the lengths you're willing to drink Mountain Dew for black-footed ferret conservation. And that's super impressive.
Well, I don't know if
impressive.
It's the same with other, we're covering other endangered species. I don't really get to work with a lot of the managers for other species, but I tell you, the people that work with the black-footed ferret, they're so passionate and dedicated to the species. Every one of them is just passionate and will bend over backwards to get the job done. And we're a pretty amazing group. You know, we are the BFFs, you know, for black-footed ferret. So truly, I mean, hardcore, and people just, they sacrifice a lot to save the species.
That's such an amazing thing to hear, and especially from you, an expert out in the field, because without you guys and without these heroic efforts, and of course the dog Shep that you had mentioned earlier that found a member of the black-footed ferrets when we had thought that they were extinct, is just remarkable, because without the teamwork, different states, different zoos working together, the government, the recovery efforts wouldn't have happened. And it's a great example of what can happen when people come together, regulations are put in place. And for me, it's a feel good story as far as the recovery efforts that have been made. And I know they're still not completely out of the woods, and we'll touch on that in a little bit. But really good things have been happening for these guys in the past 20 years, thanks to people like yourself and, as you said, many others. And so I can just picture all of you guys out at nighttime with your Mountain Dew and your lights and working hard to make sure these guys are safe and healthy. And it's really inspiring. So I keep fighting the good fight, I would say.
Yeah, I work with a lot of the field guys. They're just so passionate. And, you know, they're the really ones that are finding the ferrets. And I'm still my geeky lab person. I just, as my field work, I really just take my lab to the field, you know. And so I work mm-hmm. with Travis Laveri, and he is the field expert for me. And he drags me all around, and he's the one out there, you know, listening to rock and roll out in the prairie, you know, finding ferrets for me. So they're, you know, it's pretty amazing. And these landowners, there's a lot of private landowners, incentives, ranchers that are helping save endangered species like black-footed ferrets. And they, you know, allow us to come out on their property and find ferrets. And, you know, they maintain the prairie dog. They allow the prairie dog population to be out there. And so it's really this effort that, you know, spans beyond science and zoos. It really takes these, you know, the community too, to save a species like the ferret.
And that's so cool. The people are doing it, and are, like you said, the landowners and the government, and just recognizing that this is a truly unique mammal, and native to North America only, and highly endangered, and a critical component of the prairie system too. So
Ferret Recovery Program is really a great model for how we can plan other endangered species recovery, because it not only works with the government, you know, the federal and the state level, it works with scientists, it works with landowners, and it takes all of us to save this unique species.
Right, and then those efforts are able to go forward, and putting them all together, we are seeing positive outcomes, which is just very exciting, and that's why I'm so happy for the listeners that they get to hear your point of view today. And I must ask, because I was surprised to find out when I was researching black-footed ferrets, I must ask your opinion about domestic ferrets as a pet. There's numbers out there that they are the third most popular pet in North America, and there's 5 to 7 million of them as pets in North America. And so I was just wondering if you could maybe explain a little bit to the listeners about the difference between black-footed ferrets and then domestic ferrets.
Actually, the domestic ferret popularity is one of the things that helped rescue the black-footed ferret. Because of people using them, particularly in Europe, I think it started with using them for hunting, they had to learn how to create these ferrets. So they learned a lot about what they ate, the reproductive biology, and we used all of that for the black-footed ferret. So it's pretty amazing, and we do continue to use them as a model, learning about their physiology, nutrition. But they're kind of a unique animal to have as a pet, the domestic ferret. They're kind of cat-like, but in a dog-like manner. They're very sneaky. They're kind of like nocturnal, almost like the cats are. But they're kind of dog-like, and the way they interact with you. And so I've never had one, but a lot of my friends do have them, and they just seem like they're really a cool pet to have.
Interesting. And are they stinky?
Well, I think they're de-scented, but they still kind of have their unique odor.
It's probably some
of their oil glands, too. But yeah, they still kind of have a bit of a smell. But they're totally different than black-footed ferrets. And zoos and other breeding programs, like at the Fish and Wildlife Service, they really try to keep these animals wild. And so we make sure that we breed, and all individuals have a chance to breed, to make sure they pass their genes on to the next generation. None of them are held like you would hold a domestic ferret. They're kept wild, because even sometimes adults that are healthy will be released into the wild. So we make sure that we don't interact with them that would somehow make them more domesticated, or we make sure that we maintain the gene pool that we started with.
So no snuggling black-footed ferrets.
No, you wouldn't want to, for sure.
I was going to say, the way you describe them being so strong, it probably doesn't sound like a very snuggly animal at any rate. So, and now, throughout your tenure, do you have a favorite black-footed ferret that you worked with? Or that you know from the wild, like maybe a sneaky mass bandit, the elusive one or something?
Not really. I don't get to interact with them that way. They have named one after my son, which thankfully he was a very good breeder. So there's lots of offspring coming from him. It wasn't a dud.
Good. Okay. Okay. Excellent.
So, but no, they're they definitely have their own personalities, I think, for sure. And we can definitely tell in the wild when we're trapping them up if they're captive or versus wild. They behave slightly differently towards people.
Well, in the preconditioning program, can you tell the listeners a little bit about that, a little bit more in detail?
Sure. So in 1991, the captive program had produced enough ferrets, and they were pretty good. They had the groove on. They thought, okay, now it's time to get them back out in the wild. And they released about 50 individuals back into Wyoming, not the same site, back into Wyoming, and they didn't fare well. Basically, what happened is coyotes, which see them as a competitor, killed a lot of them. And so we had to take a step back. If they're kind of not understanding that they live in burrows and they need to find food, we need to train them. And because every individual is so valuable to the program. And so what they do, they go, like as I mentioned earlier, they go through boot camp, and basically a mom with her 60-day, two-month-old kits will go out to these outdoor pens that have a burrow system dug by the prairie dogs. So ferrets not only kill and eat prairie dogs, then they steal their homes.
Right, when they're sleeping.
Yes, right.
So they get them when they're sleeping.
Sneaky. Yes,
and then they steal their homes.
Then they
love
these
guys.
It's like, you know, sleeping with the enemy, really.
So goodness.
So they learn to live in the burrow system. In fact, you know, they thought maybe they just weren't aware of predators or competitors, and so in the beginning, Brian Miller did some research at the Smithsonian where they took a stuffed badger, and they put him on a remote control car. And they drove him around. His name, of course, was Robo Badger, and chased ferrets around to make sure that they would run into the burrows. But it really was about them living outside and in the burrow system that made them successful. And so they, the mom does a lot of training with her kit, and she trains them to kill prey. And so they start sort of with a smaller, like a mouse. And then they build up to a prairie dog. Okay. They have to be able to kill a prairie dog in order to be released into the wild. Like I said, every individual is so valuable. You know, and kids really hate that part of the story, but honestly, to save ferrets, we have to save the prairie dog. And there's so much human-wildlife conflict where it comes with them, with prairie dogs, because they eat grasses and other plants, compete for the lands with cattle and agriculture and urban development. So a lot of them are poisoned. And so ferrets need prairie dogs. That's the end of the story right there. And so in order to save the prairie dog, which is the keystone species of the prairie ecosystem, we have to use the ferret.
Yeah, and you bring up a really good point with reintroducing carnivores, which a black-footed ferret is a carnivore, can be tricky because, like you said, a lot of times the moms have to teach the babies, the offspring, how to hunt. And if they're not able to do that in a, when they're housed under human care, it can be really tough when they're released. So there's not, there's starting to be more success stories, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's starting to be more success stories of carnivores being re-released into the wild. But historically, it's been problematic because of that issue of them not knowing how to hunt, where a lot of your more hoofstock species, which I'm familiar with, they eat grass. And unless they're obligate type of herbivores or browsers that need something specific that's not around, they might need a little bit of training, but obviously not as much because it's not as big a skill set to just munch on grass. And they can often do really well when they're released into the wild, depending on the location and if it's supported. But carnivores have been tricky. And so the fact that through all these collaborative efforts and research and science and animal caretakers, the fact that everybody did figure out the best way to precondition and then release a ferret that has been born under human care back into the wild is just a really incredible story, and I applaud everything that you guys are doing. It's just really, it's really good.
They are. Yeah. And, you know, it's just not about hunting, but it's, as you know, when you start a new exercise routine, it's about developing those muscles, you know, and that's also why living in the burrow system is so good, because they develop those muscles to, you know, be able to run across the prairie to dig and to be in the burrows, and then also to be able to kill their prey. And the only thing about why black-footed ferrets versus a domestic ferret is not a good animal as a pet is that to kill their prey, they usually do a neck bite and suffocate the prairie dog. Well, if you get bit by a ferret, they don't let go. So that's because that's how they hunt, right? So they bite and they don't let go. So that prairie dog, you know, doesn't have a chance, basically, because it's the ferrets are very tenacious. They, you know, are ferocious. They, you know, that's why I say that they're luckily they're only 1 kilogram. And, you know, no threat to us, of course, but, you know, prairie dogs, you know, that's what they evolved to kill. So.
And so what is the current status of the black-footed ferrets in the wild?
There's about 300 to 400 in the wild, and we have about 28 reintroduction sites. Some of them are more active than others, or have more or less ferrets, and that ranges from Canada down into Mexico.
Oh, wow. Okay. Big range.
Yeah, wherever you find prairie dogs is where you find, we used to find black-footed ferrets.
Gotcha. And now, do you think their population would be sustainable in the wild without the captive breeding efforts?
Not at this point. There's a couple major issues that we have to overcome. And some of that is just good habitat, you know, having the prairie dogs. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, of course, with, you know, the changes in the weather and climate change, you know, it's going to influence the grasses and where the prairie dogs are. So that's one of our challenges. We do have a new incentive with private landowners. Ranchers can get a certain dollar amount per acre to maintain prairie dogs and allow us to put black-footed ferrets there. And I think that's going to be successful at providing corridors between these larger sites that we might have that's on mm-hmm. more public land, like U.S. Forest land, service land, or National Park Service land, where we have a lot of opportunities to maintain those prairie dogs.
That's so cool. I mean, the incentive programs can be really helpful.
Yeah, and it's really getting the community out there to see that prairie dogs can be out there. That's where they belong naturally with the ecosystem. That's how the ecosystem evolved with them there. They maintain that prairie. Mm-hmm. So they're very important.
Right. They're the not only the prairie dogs, but the black-footed ferrets, they're all indicators of a very healthy prairie system, which I'm sure the ranchers want for their animals to graze on.
The prairie dogs actually keep the grasses at a shorter level that makes it more nutritious. And that's why cattle want to feed on prairie dog towns. But the issue is overgrazing and then drought, you know, when it's a drought, all those kind of issues playing a factor and being able to maintain both.
Mm-hmm. And so besides habitats, are there any other pressures that black-footed ferrets are facing?
Yeah, there was a disease that was introduced from Asia called sabbatic plague. Okay. And it's the same sort of bacteria that caused the Black Death in Europe, wiping out huge numbers of humans in Europe. So in the early 1900s, a ship from China had rats, and the rats got off the boat and basically brought this disease. They were carrying the fleas that had sabbatic plague, and it just spread up through the ground squirrel population, starting in California, and now it's up through prairie dogs into South Dakota, and it kills prairie dogs and almost instantaneously kills black-footed ferrets. And so we have been able to develop a vaccine for black-footed ferrets that protects them from plague. It came from the U.S. Army, mm-hmm. and the USGS actually converted it and made it applicable to black-footed ferrets. And now they actually have a bait vaccine that they're testing in the field for prairie dogs. Because, you know, you can save the ferret, you know, protect it from plague, but if you can't save their prey, then they're not going to thrive either.
Right, so, their food source.
Right, mm-hmm. so they're developing all this. You know, our species just did not evolve with it. So a lot of them succumb to it, like ferrets mm-hmm. and prairie dogs, and others could be potential carriers like coyotes.
Wow, that's incredible. But I'm glad to hear that they're working towards vaccinations that will help these guys and then potentially their feed and potentially their food source, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And one of the things I love about the ferret program is how scientific it is and how many different people work together to solve these issues.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And now, what would you say to somebody who asked the question, which is not going to be me, clearly, because I'm a black-footed ferret fan. But what would you say to somebody who questions spending all this money and time to help save the black-footed ferret?
They are probably just a small player when it comes to the prairie ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know, they do only eat prairie dogs, but there are a lot of things that rely on the prairie dogs, you know, anything from invertebrates and reptiles
and the grasses,
birds
too.
Yeah, and the grasses and birds, you know, lots of things either eat them or use their burrows or, you know, help the grasses be maintained. But no one, you know, people really have this conflict with them because of the agriculture and cattle ranches and urban development. And so we need to save the black-footed ferret in order to save the prairie ecosystem, which really means we're using it to save the prairie dog.
Very good. I agree wholeheartedly. But one of the things, too, we try to always focus on positives with the podcast and all the good things that are being done. But some of these stories, reading them day after day, it can often be disheartening or will with conservation, I know that there's always, of course, conservation and research and science, there's always 3 steps forward, 1 step back, sometimes 2 steps back, sometimes 4 steps back. But luckily, there's a lot of amazing people like yourself that are willing to keep trying to take those steps forwards to save species like the black-footed ferret. So my question is, what do you do to keep staying motivated and the others around you in that specialize in conserving black-footed ferrets to stay motivated to keep fighting the good fight for the black-footed ferrets?
Yeah, you know, with the ferret program, it's a good story because, first of all, we screwed up. Basically, there was a poisoning campaign sponsored by the government to poison prairie dogs. You know, and it started with strychnine and the other poisons now. Who knows what else it was wiping out? And, you know, we acknowledge mm-hmm. that, and we're trying to fix it. And we've been very successful. 9,000 mm-hmm. black-footed ferrets, right? We've produced that in 30 years. It's amazing. We've been very successful. And
it's incredible.
As I mentioned, you know, the science that goes behind the species – we learn so quickly. They have a very short generation time, meaning they're reproducing within their first year. And so we can change management, do different diets, different strategies, and see effects immediately. Other programs can't do that. There's a social structure maybe mm-hmm. that comes with sexual maturity or takes so long to reach sexual maturity that they may not be able to breed until they're, you know, three or 4 years of age, or until they disperse away from their group. And so we can really use them as a model for other zoo and human managed populations to see what has worked and what has failed. You know, just like the boot camp training, what does it take to make them wild again, completely being able to survive in the wild? So all this stuff people can use from the ferret program.
Very cool.
And so it just, you know, we do have a bit of a crisis. It seems like our jobs are always in crisis mode because we're always yeah. trying to save something. And it gets overwhelming sometimes. But like I said, finding that zoo-born, zoo-preconditioned ferret in Mexico, one of the harshest climates, you know, environments at that time, because they were going through a huge drought for many years, you know, and just seeing like we can do it, you know, and ferrets are a great example, particularly for endangered carnivores, because they're pretty sensitive to, you know, this inbreeding depression. You know, again, the ferrets come from 7 founders, you know, they're mm-hmm. very closely related. Actually, when they breed, they're breeding with their half sib. So they pretty much okay. always share a parent. So mm-hmm. we could just learn and also test the theories of evolutionary biology if you want to put it on your academic hat. This is a really cool species mm-hmm. to figure out what's going to work. And with zoo programs, you know, we really can see, you know, it can be successful. We can do this. And we are conservation entities when it comes to being a zoo.
Right. Wonderful. Which is one of the reasons why not only, you know, I'm so proud to have my roots with Lincoln Park Zoo. They do amazing conservation work. I've highlighted them a little bit on different podcasts. I try to hold back to not be biased. But of course, they're one of the top in the country and they do really cool things. And zoos in general put a lot of money towards conservation efforts in the wild. And they should be applauded because they're doing really great things. And like you said, the black-footed ferret is just an example of many other efforts that are being put out there. And so one of my last questions is, if you're a listener and you're not sure how, you love the black-footed ferret and you love their story and you want to learn more about them, or just in general, you want to help their conservation efforts, what could an average person
yeah,
do
so
to help
I think
the black-footed ferret?
Wildlife conservation can always start in your back door. You know, what can you do? Even if it's like properly throwing out your trash, recycling, you know, some of these things you can just really do, and it doesn't have to be necessarily donating money. You know, visiting a zoo and spending time at the zoo and learning and about mm-hmm. these different species is an easy way to help with wildlife conservation. But for ferrets, you know, we do have a Blackfoot Ferret Friends mm-hmm. group, and you can find that on our website, which is www.blackfootedferret.org. Oh. And there's great information. It's a great resource there. And, you know, there's opportunities to okay. support ferrets financially if you want to. There's many zoos around the country that have ferrets. And so supporting those zoos is always a good way to support wildlife conservation and species like black-footed ferrets.
And so after this interview, we're all going to go check out blackfootedferret.org and see what cool things are going on and learn more about them. And or you can listen, if you haven't had the chance, you can listen to our podcast specifically on black-footed ferrets and find out more details about their behavior, reproduction, and physiology. But I really want to thank you, Dr. Santemeyer, for your time today. And I learned a lot. Of course, I know a lot about you in general, but we were usually talking about different things, and I don't get a chance to just pick your brain about black-footed ferrets and listen to all the amazing work that you're doing. So thank you so much today. You're by far one of my favorite people in the world, and I just really appreciate your time and sharing your passion and dedication with the black-footed ferrets with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.